So we have this illusion that we own and are somebody in a sense that is very mistaken. Of course we are somebody, but it's something that's changing continually. And all the things that are arising through what they call the seeds that develop, become our experience. And then we project that experience and project it as something personal, as something that's mine. And our practice is about seeing that. Our practice is just to see how the mind is working. And as we sit, we, instead of getting in the car and going to work and meeting the people we're always used to, once we sit down, then our brain starts shooting up all these different stories. And they're all about us and our experience. And as we sit, the longer we sit, the more strongly we begin to realize that we're not in any of those places. We're not there. We're here. So whatever the mind is all those images and all those stories that are being generated through us are simply an illusion, so that we don't need to worry about ourselves so much. We don't need to project ourselves into the world and become somebody. We're already what we are. We're already here. And so with that realization, if it's a very profound one, we realize that this is what is meant by Buddha. It's not out there somewhere. It's not some golden flash of insight. It's simply being right here and totally accepting it as it is without making it into something else. And so the Alaya Vijana, the storehouse, doesn't go away. They say it becomes filled with light. It becomes luminous. That the world itself becomes luminous. At first they divide it. They say, oh, there's the world of suffering. And then everybody tries, I'll sit and I'll get through the suffering and transform and transcend it. But in Buddhism, there's no transcendence. There is transformation. And the transformation comes by our willingness to submit ourselves to the way things are, to surrender to it, in some sense to kiss ourselves goodbye. And it doesn't mean we throw ourselves away, it just means we stop thinking about ourselves so much. You know, most of everybody's mind is just about, you know, me. But with practice, that becomes a kind of transparent me-ness. It's still there, but there's light shining through it because it's not so personal anymore. So this is about practice. This is hard to talk about because these are clumsy words, because this is about the experience of sitting itself. And a sitting for long and with deep sincerity. So there's, I don't know whether this is any help at all. So this talks over and over about the Aliya Vaishnana, and it begins with the five skandhas, which we just chanted. All five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering. And the five skandhas are form, feeling, perception, impulses, and consciousness. Those are all the things that go together to make up a human being. It's the body form, it's the sensitivity, the feelings, the perception of taking in what's out there. It seems like everything's out there and we're perceiving it. But actually, because we're perceiving it, there's no edge to it. We're it and it's us. And impulses, so then we act. And then consciousness, which is the mind. And that's the one part that's separate from the body part in this schematic. And it has layers of mind. The Aliya Vijnana, which is the storehouse, and then the thinking part, the manas. And the thinking part is the one that's trying to figure everything out and judge everything. This is right and wrong. I like this. I don't like that. And that's the part that confuses us. And as Buddha said, causes so much suffering. That as long as we're using our consciousness in that way, we don't understand that all of these little pieces of things that look like they're all separate, it all belongs together. It's all one thing. So Vijnana, consciousness, is cutting. V means to cut. And it's our tendency to separate. This is a piece of paper. This is a book. That's a table. That's Ron and that's Wendy. And we get stuck with that. It's not that that's incorrect. It's just that we forget that this book is connected to this paper, to this lap, to this chair, to this table, to this floor, to this earth, to this universe. And without that understanding, without living in terms of the wholeness of things as well as the separateness of things, we tend to bump into things, including mostly ourself. We stumble because we become so involved with the perception of the separation of things that we experience tremendous loneliness and a misunderstanding of where we are. Where we are in the wholeness of it. So the story is that this ten-headed king is entertaining the Buddha, and they've had a conversation, and the Buddha smiles. He had already said that he was going to answer Mahatmati's questions. Mahatmati is very eager to ask questions, and he asks a lot of them. He's supposed to be 100, but he only got to 90. So part of this, the first part of the questions chapter, is just a whole list of amazing questions. Why are there wind and clouds in the sky? It's just like being with a little kid. You know? Why are elephants, horses, and deer caught by men? So And then Buddha very kindly doesn't answer all those specific questions, but tries to get underneath them and try to explain life a little bit. So from afar, Shakra and Brahma and the four guardians beheld the Bhagavan, the Buddha, sitting and smiling at the summit of Lanka. They all asked themselves, why is he smiling and radiating light from his body? And why is he sitting there without speaking, unmoved by the bliss of samadhi or the self-realization of Buddha knowledge, and gazing like the king of beasts upon Ravana, and concerned with the progress of this ten-headed king's practice? So Mahamati knew that they were thinking this, and he knew that they really loved to hear the Buddha give instructions. So he said, why are you smiling like that? Just like a kid again. And the Buddha said, that's a good question. It's an excellent question, especially upon considering the true nature of the world and hoping to awaken beings of the past, the present, and the future from mistaken views. You've asked me about this. For a wise man should ask questions not only for his own benefit, but also for the benefit of others. Mahamati, Ravana, the lord of Lanka, has asked the Tathagatas, the fully enlightened ones, which he now wishes to ask me. And because this teaching is not something those who follow lesser paths or other teachings can understand, this ten-headed yaksha shall also ask Buddhas in the future. So as Red Pine says in his commentary, looks like this ten-headed king has been asking the same question all along, all through his many lives, and it looks like he'll keep on asking them for an infinite number of lives in the future. So then he gives predictions about the lord of Lanka, the king, that you'll see yourself seated upon a giant jeweled lotus flower, and this is all very fancy ancient Indian imagery, like the Lotus Sutra has, with jewels, beautiful jewels covering the mountains and flowers raining down. Says, this is an indescribable realm, and it is by cultivating the efficacious practices of the various stages of this path that you'll be able to see this indescribable realm and thereby experience the infinite characteristics of the Tathagata stage, which is something that has never been witnessed by followers of lesser paths. So then the lord of Lanka rose and went to cover the peak with a myriad of flawless jeweled lotuses, and a host of celestial maidens went with him with multicolored garlands and flowers of every kind and umbrellas and etc., colored flags. Then the king rose into the air very high, and many things rained down and filled the sky. So once all that fuss was over, the Buddha said, ask, Lord of Lanka, about these two kinds of dharma. He said, I've been instructed in the two kinds of dharma, but not by primordial Buddhas. The primordial Buddhas cultivate the bliss of samadhi and do not speak about realms imagined by the mind. Please explain these two kinds of dharmas. And the Buddha said, ask about these. And the king then rearranged the jeweled crown and necklaces and other ornaments that graced his body and said, The Tathagata has said that dharmas should be abandoned, and non-dharmas even more so. Bhagavan, what do you mean when you say we should abandon these two kinds of dharmas? What constitutes a dharma? And what constitutes a non-dharma? And if we should abandon something, why these two? Wouldn't this result in projecting the existence of something or the non-existence of something? Something that is real and something that is not real? If all we do is give rise to projections instead of the undifferentiated characteristics of our repository consciousness, we will behold strands of hair in the sky and realms of impure knowledge. Bhagavan, if this is the nature of dharmas, how are we to abandon them? So the repository consciousness is the Alaya Vijnana. So the for Buddhas, it's the same. There's no defiled mind. It's the same. But for Mahamati and for the Lord of Lanka, it seems like it's two things. The Buddha said, "You see how ignorant people distinguish things. Things as fragile and impermanent as a clay pot, do you not? The distinctions among dharmas and non-dharmas are the projections of foolish people and not how things are viewed according to Buddha knowledge. Lord of Lanka, foolish people see things in terms of characteristics, not the wise." So that's the V part of Vijnana. Ignorant people just see things as name and form and assume that's, and then project their themselves into the picture. It says the Buddha establishes the non-difference between dharmas and non-dharmas. Although this doesn't seem important, it will become so as non-dharmas turn out to have the same characteristics as dharmas, and dharmas are thus no more real than non-dharmas. So he went on, Lord of Lanka, fire is seen as something uniform. We say fire. But when it destroys such things as buildings or trees, its flames are distinguished depending on the shape and size of the material that burns. Why don't you see that dharmas and non-dharmas are distinguished the same way? Just as a fire is seen as a singular continuity or a diversity of flames. Sometimes we see it as one thing. Sometimes we see it as many things. Or consider the continuity of a seed, Lord of Lanka, as it gives rise to such varying forms as sprouts, stems, joints, branches, leaves, buds, flowers, and fruits. And as with external objects, the same is true of internal objects, whereby ignorance gives rise to such dharmas as skandhas, dhatus, and atiyanas, as well as to the varieties of existence in the three realms, and to differences in terms of suffering and joy, good and evil, speech and silence. So too consciousness and its objects are the same, but differ depending on distinctions as to which is superior, neutral or inferior, defiled or pure, good or bad. Not only are there distinctions among such things as these, Lord of Lanka, when yogins practice meditation, the characteristics of their internal realms are also marked by differences. How much more then are dharmas and non-dharmas marked by a multitude of distinctions? Thus, the different characteristics of dharmas and non-dharmas are the result of projection. In other words, they don't possess any characteristics of themselves. It's the way we say when we're going to astonish ourselves that we're made up of material that was part of the Big Bang, that was a part of Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, that is, we're breathing the dust motes that came from Mars, that whatever we think about us is just this very simple, temporary, cobbled up together collection that is changing continually. And so our understanding of this as a thing, a dharma, as a thing, or as not a thing, keeps us clinging to a sense of a self that is all made up. It's our thinking that creates our self. So we can operate without being self-conscious. And we often do. And those moments are sometimes our very best moments, when we have forgotten to think about ourselves and the kind of appearance that we're projecting into the world, and what other people will think of us, or whether I'm doing a good job or not. It's just doing it and being completely immersed in it. And that immersion is the way that we really are all the time. And then our minds tend to get caught by things and interested in elaborating. And if we know that the elaboration is what is happening, then we don't have to be hurt by things in the same way, because it's not personal in the way that we usually think about it. It's and if we allow ourselves to really accept the way things are, then there's a kind of freedom that we don't have otherwise. Although it doesn't make life any easier, necessarily. It's not. It's just a way of trying to reach a place of understanding the wholeness of things, as well as the bits, the dharma part of it, in a way that gives us some kind of latitude and freedom. We don't have to be caught by what we think of as ourself, because that's just another thought. We think we know how we look. We think we know what we mean. But really, we don't. We'll never see ourselves. And we'll never know how other people see us. So it's kind of, it's the same teaching as the Heart Sutra. It's just much more elaborate. And maybe I will stop there. So whatever we think we perceive isn't what we think it is. It's one way of hearing this. But there's more to it than that. So there's a little bit of time for questions or discussion. Donalyn?
So Putting this sutra in context of other sutras, like you said, that it's similar to the, you know, the Heart Sutra saying the same thing. This is written or remembered as, again, what we learned in the Lotus Sutra, is the expedient means, mm-hmm. the skillful means, that is. So it's directed, because I noticed this one seems to have all these different 8 characteristics of this, or 10 characteristics, and it seems to be putting more, much more explanation into the structure,
yeah.
understanding.
Yeah.
Yet it's, in the way that you're talking, it feels very much when we chant the Heart Sutra or what we mm-hmm. learned from even Sandokai.
Yes.
Talks about the, came to my mind talking about yeah. the store, the way that we store things. And all of the sutras were there. So is that one way, I guess, to that this sutra is another way of, I don't want to say saying the same thing, but mm-hmm. another way of showing us why this practice works or why we practice?
Yes, yes. It's kind of an argument for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems much more detailed.
Yes.
More, 108 questions.
Yeah. Yeah, well,
it's a different audience. It's a different. He's just talking different, it seems.
It is. It's written by somebody else. It's not by the same one as the Diamond Sutra, for instance. And the Diamond Sutra comes all the way back around to the ground. And I haven't finished it, but I understand from what I've read that this one, this does not. This keeps the bodhisattva in a realm of Buddha's mind. Well, I don't know how exactly to say it, because it isn't a matter of separation. It is somewhat a matter of development in this version of it, in this story, that you start out not knowing anything, you start out in ignorance, and then you slowly develop as you practice. And then come to the point where you realize that mind is Buddha. And with that realization, then you come to the second realization that no mind and no Buddha. And this isn't trying to express that, so that the no part is just as keen as the yes part, if that makes sense. So mind is Buddha, we have to say so, and yet that's not accurate unless we say no mind and no Buddha. We have to say both. And then we have to put them both aside and say nothing. And maybe smile. I think it all comes down to the smile in the end.
The smile I've been thinking about too, because, you know, why are you smiling? So it's mm-hmm. that's the transmission to it from
yes, yes. Which is to say that Buddha's mind is joyous. Yeah.
It's just I just love the
Well, it's 8.